And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This week marked what would have been the 100th birthday of Rachel Carson, who turned nature lovers into environmentalists with the publication of Silent Spring. We give gentle tribute to the silent warrior and then bring you two special whale features along with our fifth weekly Earth Summit when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Rachel Carson would have been 100 years old this week. And throughout today's show, we will be giving gentle reminders of this giant of the environmental movement. We'll be getting right to our fifth weekly Earth Summit in just a moment. And then in segment two, we bring you the Nature News Update, then two current sagas about whales. One, a follow-up on a story we did last week on those wayward whales heading up the Sacramento River. And the second, a follow-up on a story we did a while ago about the Japanese and their quest for whales. But first, I want to read you a brief news item from this week's news. Senator Benjamin Cardin from Maryland introduced a resolution to honor pioneering environmentalist Rachel Carson on the 100th anniversary of her birth. Carson's 1962 book, Silent Spring, which revealed the harmful effects of pesticides, helped launch the environmental movement. His resolution was written acknowledging her legacy of scientific rigor, coupled with her poetic sensibility. However, the resolution was forced to be withdrawn due to action of Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, who vociferously accused Carson of using junk science to turn the public against chemicals like DDT. To date, I will read excerpts from Carson's writings. I begin with the following, which was from a letter to the editor she wrote to the Washington Post in 1953. The real wealth of the nation lies in the resources of the earth, soil, water, forests, minerals, and wildlife. To utilize them for present needs while ensuring their preservation for future generations requires a delicately balanced and continuing program based on the most extensive research. Their administration is not properly and cannot be a matter of politics. By long tradition, the agencies responsible for these resources have been directed by men of professional stature and experience who have understood, respected, and been guided by the findings of their scientists. These actions with the Interior Department fall into place beside the proposed giveaways of our offshore oil reserves and the threatened invasion of national parks, forests, and public lands. For many years, public-spirited citizens throughout the country have been working for conservation of the natural resources, realizing their vital importance to the nation. Apparently, hard-won progress is to be wiped out as a politically minded administration returns us to the dark age of unrestrained exploitation and destruction. It is one of the ironies of our times that while concentrating on the defense of our country against enemies from without, we should be so heedless to those who destroy it from within. That's the end of Rachel Carson's quote. I dedicate all of Ms. Carson's writings, which I'll read throughout the show, to Senator Coburn. I will send him a letter with these writings. So now, on to the rest of the show. It takes all kinds for change. Some of us are committed to our public lands. Some are working hard for the oceans. Many have great sympathy for the loss of the wonder as animals disappear in record numbers, while the world seems to be awakening to the specter of global weirding. That's why we bring you each week a spectrum of thoughts by our regular contributors to the Weekly Earth Summit. Let the summit begin.
Welcome
Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit. This is Sydney Wildsmith, and I've received a variety of thoughts from our regular panelists who send them out around the world each week. There's plenty to contemplate, so let's get started with Dr. Matthew Sleeth, who's about to make an offer that sounds almost too good to be true. Dr. Sleeth?
Today, I want to share how everyone can get $20,000 worth of solar equipment for just $20. Many of us want to do more to use less energy, but solar equipment such as photovoltaic panels are expensive. A modest 1.8 kilowatt system can cost about $20,000. Let's say that I did have $20,000 to spend on a photovoltaic system. How much energy could I expect to make? Nationally, $20,000 worth of equipment nets about 150 kilowatt hours of energy per month. Those in Erie will get less, and dwellers in Phoenix and San Diego will do better. So, how can you get the equipment to net 150 kilowatt hours of energy every month for just $20? Put up a clothesline. The average clothes dryer uses 150 kilowatt hours of energy a month. Clothes dryers are one of the home's big energy hogs. That's why they require the large 220-volt cords. Each load dried in a dryer makes 5 pounds of greenhouse gases. A clothesline saves 150 kilowatt hours of energy per month, and a kilowatt saved is a kilowatt earned. Additionally, you'll get a little exercise and have clothes that last twice as long. You'll never see a slick ad for clothesline, but that doesn't mean it isn't a piece of solar technology worth owning or giving as a gift.
Matthew Sleeth brings his common sense advice to the world each week from his experience in downsizing his family's lifestyle to accommodate to a sustainable future. Thank you, Dr. Sleeth. Now, good advice is sometimes overlooked, but we are finding that more frequently good science is driving some provocative new ideas, and it's beginning to show up in meaningful changes. Dr. Mark Beckhoff works with animals to explore and then promote a new awareness of their awareness. Dr. Beckhoff?
One of the real exciting things in my field, ethology, cognitive ethology, the study of animal minds, study of animal emotions, is there's always surprises. So one big surprise was last fall, we discovered that mice are empathic, that when a mouse sees another mouse in pain, they experience the pain of that mouse, and they show a lower threshold to pain. We also discovered that whales have spindle cells, and spindle cells were thought only to exist in humans and other great apes. But now we know whales have them, and whales have more of them, and they are very important in experiencing emotions and intuition and gut reactions, emotional gut reactions. So people who have studied whales know and have told me over and over again that they're emotional beings. But some really interesting stuff comes out, and I'm really interested in how the press is picking things up. The New York Times is constantly having articles on animal cognition. Do animals have a sense of time? The notion of empathy in animals. And right before I started talking, you know, to Sydney, there was an article called I Am an Elephant that appeared in a newspaper in Philadelphia that really, really decried the keeping of elephants in captivity and how they need to go to sanctuaries and not be kept in little prison-like cages in zoos. And what's really neat about that is the popular press is getting into the story about the way elephants and, of course, other animals suffer trauma. And what's really interesting is that 6 zoos in America have decided that they would be closing their elephant exhibits as the elephants passed away or got ill and had to be sent to a sanctuary, including the Bronx Zoo, the Detroit Zoo, the Philadelphia Zoo. So that's new. And recently I saw an article that fishermen have fishermen who are getting now very frustrated that overfishing has caused the depletion of the fish who they try to catch for fun or for food. And out in Oregon, because of the decrease in salmon, fishermen are starting to shoot sea lions. And I'm saying that as, of course, that's a horrible thing. But, you know, once again, that's what's happening. So I think the exciting thing in my field is that we're continually learning about the fascinating worlds of animals, their emotional and their intellectual abilities.
We've devoted an entire show to Dr. Bekoff's work, which you can easily find by Googling B-E-K-O-F-F on the Google search block on the Wildside News homepage. Unfortunately, the advances so many of us are experiencing have seemed in the last number of years to be countered by the effects of power and politics, and perhaps nowhere is it more challenging than in some of our agency policies that have taken a beating of late. Dave Foreman, who lives and works in the Southwest, is dedicated to restoring vast stretches of open and interconnected habitat to create extensive land bridges of healthy ground to restore a natural order. He runs into obstacles regularly. Dave?
Most Americans, when they hear the name United States Fish and Wildlife Service, would logically think that it's an agency designed to protect animals, and in some cases they're right. However, for much of its history, the Fish and Wildlife Service's main mission has been to kill animals, and particularly predators and other troublesome species like prairie dogs. During the first half of the 20th century, the Fish and Wildlife Service conducted an extermination campaign to get rid of predators such as wolves, mountain lions, and grizzly bears from the lower 48 states. But in the 1980s and 1990s, with the turnaround in public attitude towards large carnivores, the Fish and Wildlife Service led the effort to recover wolves in the western United States, the wolves indeed that it once killed. And this led to the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone National Park in 1995. And in Arizona and New Mexico in 1997, the reintroduction in the wild of the lobo, the Mexican wolf, the most endangered carnivore in the world. Dave Parsons, now of the Rewilding Institute, led this effort as the team leader for the Fish and Wildlife Service. But now, under the political commissars of the Bush administration, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has turned to its old ways and is leading a second extinction campaign of lobos in the wild, doing this for a handful of public land ranchers. Right now, violating all the recommendations from conservation biologists and others and their former guidelines, the Fish and Wildlife Service, lack of management, lack of protection, willingness to kill the endangered lobos in the wild if they so much as look at a cow, is leading rapidly to their extermination in the wild. If India mismanaged its tigers in the reprehensible way the United States is managing its lobos, the world would be outraged. If Kenya was mismanaging its lions the way the Federal Wildlife Agency is mismanaging our lobos, there would be an international outcry. And if Spain had a war of elimination against its wolves and against the highly endangered Iberian lynx, there would be outrage all over the world. But the United States is now exterminating the lobo in the southwestern United States. And where is the outrage? Where is the international outcry? Indeed, where is the national outcry? It's an outrage going on now in Arizona and New Mexico for a handful of public lands ranchers, and it's being conducted by our federal government and by the political commissars that the Bush administration has put into the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. I want to encourage listeners to write your member of Congress and your United States senators to protest what has happened with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and to call on Congress to have oversight hearings on the Fish and Wildlife Service's war of extermination against the lobo in the southwestern United States.
Thanks, Dave Foreman of the Rewilding Institute. This basis for maintaining vast stretches of the natural landscape has some surprising, often difficult to recognize dynamics that, if altered, can have ripple effects over vast stretches and spaces. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who directs the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment, weighs in on this expanded perspective. Dr. Lovejoy?
People have been concerned for some time now about tropical rainforests. And they are great biological treasure troves. But one of the things that is quite remarkable, in particular about the Amazon, but it probably occurs too in other tropical forests as well, the Amazon literally makes half of its own rainfall. And it does this because the air moves from the Atlantic to the Andes. It brings moisture from the ocean. It drops as rain. And then it evaporates off the complex surfaces of the forest, and the trees are exhaling moisture, and that turns into clouds and rain farther to the west. So ultimately, if you cut down too much of the forest, you break that cycle and you can't even grow a rainforest. One of the really interesting things we know now is that something like 40% of the rain south of the Amazon, South America, actually comes from the Amazon. So in the end, people who don't care about that extraordinary variety of living things in the rainforest don't necessarily care about forests, certainly need to care about it as a rain machine. And it's just one more example of how interdependent we are with nature and are only just beginning to appreciate.
Thank you, Dr. Lovejoy. Good science is blending into a more holistic understanding of the many dimensions involved in the living world. And even as research continues, so too the debates, often between the scientists themselves, about how this is playing out and our future. Dr. Robin Moore, who faces the daunting challenge of awakening the world to the fact that the amphibians as a class of animals are facing the possibility of total collapse within 10 years, pushes the questions as the future reality is being felt. Dr. Moore.
In this month's edition of the journal Nature, an article by Ross Alford and co-workers in Australia fuels debate on the role that climate change is playing in global amphibian declines. The article is a response to a study by Alan Pounds and co-authors linking the decline of amphibians as a result of a fungal disease, chytridiomycosis, or chytrid for short, to climate change in Costa Rica. Pounds and colleagues propose the mechanism for disease outbreaks in which global warming favors a pathogen by shifting temperatures towards its optimum. Unusual climatic conditions may also stress amphibians, potentially altering development and raising susceptibility to chytrid fungus as well as other diseases. The analysis of Pounds et al. Has been questioned by many authors, who are skeptical of the real relationship they state, sparking debate on the role of climate change in amphibian declines. Alford and team present data from amphibian declines in Queensland, in which the period of regional declines coincides with dramatic regional warming, mirroring the global trend, while Alford and colleagues suggest that multi-year warm periods are more important in amphibian declines than single warm years. The patterns from the Australian tropics that they present agree with the climate-linked epidemic hypothesis presented by Pounds. While analyses linking climate change with amphibian declines may be contested, evidence is definitely mounting that climate change and amphibian declines are frequently linked. To me, this raises a question about the trade-offs between continued research and conservation action. What point do we consider the evidence to be conclusive enough to take appropriate action to mitigate the threat? Personally, I favor the precautionary approach. I don't question the importance of strong scientific evidence in providing credibility to an argument, and I do think scientific debate is healthy. I also think it is important to act in the midst of a crisis, even if all the pieces do not yet seem to be in place. While people continue to debate whether amphibians are really declining and whether climate change really plays a role, I think it's prudent to accept the very real possibility that both are in fact occurring, and do what we can to reverse these alarming trends.
Dr. Moore works with Conservation International, which, like the Rewilding Institute, is reconnecting the critical habitats around the world. Their work requires much greater support. One area that is receiving a lot of attention these days is energy and its sources. That debate will not be settled for many years, but that debate must be waged. Carl Pope, who leads the Sierra Club, weighs in on one of the proposed good solutions for our energy future. Carl?
Retro can be fun. The Bee Gees singing Saturday Night Fever won't kill you. But when we're told that our energy future is a choice between Coolidge-era coal burners and Khrushchev-era nukes, nostalgia's killing us. Liquid coal is the latest deadly retro fad. It's an apartheid-era South African technology to make coal a motor fuel. It's filthy and dangerous. What an oil addict shoots up when he's desperate. Most of its energy is turned into waste carbon pollution. A car that runs on coal is more than twice as dirty as one that runs on Arabian crude. It's wildly economic. You can't afford it. But Washington can fix that. Just pump the coal full enough of taxpayer dollars. Guarantee the government will buy it, however dirty and expensive, and voila, coal industry campaign contributors get grateful, and our climate gets fried. This is a fix for our oil addiction we don't need and can't afford.
The Sierra Club. Now that's one organization that's been standing up for land, people, and our heritage for a very long time. And you'll find a Sierra Club and members in every community. There's a lot being heaped onto the dreams of the new environmentalists. It's fascinating to see this historic effort being carried now by the newly enfranchised. Ben Lowe has taken up that challenge, and he talks about it now. Ben?
Our world is in a mess. Have you seen the signs? I've seen how we blow up entire mountains to get at coal underneath. I've seen street children with swollen bellies picking through mounds of garbage for food. I've seen forests burning and rivers dying. I've seen the reports and bleak predictions for our future, the future that I'm inheriting. I've seen these things, and they cannot be hidden from my conscience any longer. But do we still stand a chance? Is it even possible to fix? I hear this question a lot, and I can certainly relate to that feeling. It's easy to despair, and I often feel overwhelmed. But whenever I need inspiration, I look to my peers, and I see a passion and an idealism that energizes me. My generation has a big role to play today, and we have the power to bring real, lasting good. I'm reminded of Wilberforce and his campaign to outlaw slavery in England. They recently released a film on this story called Amazing Grace. In it, the young Prime Minister William Pitt tells his abolitionist friend, Wilberforce, "We're too young to realize that certain things are impossible, so we'll do them anyway." I think there's a lot of truth to that. They eventually succeeded in the huge task before them. And by the grace of God, so will we.
When you wonder what to do, a great choice may be to locate a youthful warrior and mentor them, support them, give them the encouragement they will need to carry on. And that's what our final regular guest is going to offer up, and that is his sage advice on what needs to be done with this enormous challenge from the perspective of a scientist and visionary who determined a few years back that it was time to get busy and really get things done. Dr. Charles Kennell.
I would say that the time for diagnosis is over. We know a lot of what the problems are. We can't wait for a perfect understanding of the sustainability diseases that we have to start working on them. And we have to make progress in many, many different areas. And and I would say that it's now time to stop diagnosing, start writing prescriptions, start developing cures.
As director of Scripps Institution of Oceanography, Dr. Kennell has experienced the most contiguous and complex ecosystem on Earth. Thank you, Dr. Kennell, and thank you for joining us for the Weekly Earth Summit. We close segment one on the Wild Side News here with a reading from the speech Rachel Carson delivered in acceptance of the National Book Award in 1963, and dedicate this to Senator Tom Coburn, our next Pombo. Ms. Carson said, Mankind has gone very far into an artificial world of his own creation. He has sought to insulate himself in his cities of steel and concrete from the realities of earth and water and growing seed. Intoxicated with a sense of his own power, he seems to be going farther and farther into more experiments for the destruction of himself and his world. There is certainly no single remedy for this condition, and I am offering no panacea. But it seems reasonable to believe, and I do believe, that the more clearly we can focus our attention on the wonders and the realities of the universe about us, the less taste we shall have for the destruction of our race. Wonder and humility are wholesome emotions, and they do not exist side by side with a lust for destruction. Rachel Carson, 1963. Stay tuned as we explore a timely example of exactly this dilemma when we head to California and Alaska for Two Tales of Whales, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
In just a moment, we continue our juxtaposition of spirit as we dedicate this show to two diametrically opposed souls, Rachel Carson, who would have turned 100 this week, and to Senator Tom Coburn, who blocked a tribute to her legacy as we explore two diametrically opposed stories that focus on humpback whales. When your Voice of the Earth continues, here on the Wild Side News. This week's Wild Side News continues as we face the paradoxes of reality. We continue our interpretation and tribute to Rachel Carson and Senator Tom Coburn with an update on the wayward whales and a direct report from Anchorage, Alaska and the International Whaling Commission meetings. All of that coming up. But first, this week's Nature News Update. The first Pacific hurricane formed on Wednesday and is heading for the west coast of Mexico. Hurricane Barbara is moving slowly towards the coast, about 100 miles south of the state of Oaxaca. Barbara follows on Hurricane Alvin. Having two storms in May is unprecedented, having occurred only twice before, in 1984 and in 1956. Warm sea temperatures in the Pacific are being blamed as a probable cause for two storms to be reported already this year. Hurricane centers earlier announced that they expected 2007 to have larger and more frequent storms than usual. Prospects of large-scale pipelines from Alaska and the Arctic Circle to Canadian and U.S. consumers may be becoming economically untenable, according to ExxonMobil corporate chief executive Rex Tillerson. The cost of the proposed Mackenzie River Delta project has doubled in recent years. Tillerson bemoaned the fact that unless a more economically tenable pricing structure could be arranged with the Canadian government, the project was not viable. I repeat, Tillerson says it ain't going to happen unless the Canadian government... Oh, whatever. Outside of a few stories of eco-terrorism and the gnashing of ships in the Antarctic, most environmental stories don't really have a lot of high drama. However, a recent murder of one of Canada's most generous and dedicated environmental philanthropists, Glenn Davis, in an underground garage following a meeting in the building that houses the World Wildlife Fund, changes that legacy considerably. Glenn Davis, a reclusive Toronto millionaire philanthropist, was killed by two gunshot wounds this past week. Police have released a video which they state shows a man who they believe may have been the killer. Just over a year ago, Mr. Davis was violently attacked by a baseball bat-wielding assailant. He survived when his attack was thwarted by people who intervened. No suspect was apprehended. If anyone has information and or leads to this crime, contact the host of this show or the Toronto Crime Stoppers School Office. You can contact them at www.222tips.com. That's 222tips.com. Or you can also call them at their office, 416-808-7260. That's in Canada. At the current meeting of the International Whaling Commission in Anchorage, charges are being made that military exercises planned by Australia and the United States next month off the Australian coast could result in serious harm and even large-scale death to large marine mammals. More than 120 military aircraft, tanks, and 30 warships, including nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and submarines, will take part in this year's Talisman Saber maneuvers. Past studies have shown that high-intensity sonar can cause internal bleeding and tissue damage and lead to disorientation, pain, beachings, and death of large ocean mammals. Military spokesman for the Australian Force said that procedures require marine mammal scans in the areas of operation. However, whale experts counter that the effects of these massive sonar blasts can have effects far beyond the defined no-pulse zones. Since August of 2004, over 40 tons of illegal elephant ivory have been seized. 40 tons is a lot of ivory. Northern and Southern African nations, however, are split on a proposed 20-year ivory trade ban to reduce the illegal trade. As in so many other environmental debates, one side claims that in order to protect their diminished herds of elephants, of which as many as 23,000 animals were killed in 2006 alone, the ivory trade must be banned. On the other side, Zimbabwe's Parks and Wildlife Authority feel that they are being unfairly pressed to protect elephants, as elephant populations have soared to over 100,000, which is twice the expected carrying capacity for the country. So, meanwhile, elephants are being killed as we speak, ivory is being taken, and secret deals are being made, and ivory silently transferred all around the world. And finally, seems regional accents are not only common amongst northern and southern U.S. citizens, and almost any country one can think of, but scientists have once again done the research to announce that dolphins living off the coast of Wales whistle, bark, and groan in a different dialect from their dolphin cousins off the western coast of Ireland. After analyzing 1,882 whistles from bottlenose dolphins, the voting is in, and of the 32 distinct sound categories, 8 were unique to the Irish dolphin members. It was also surmised that further studies may prove that the Irish dolphins are quicker to pick fights and stage protests. Researchers will pursue this further study once the proper funding is available. Until then, however, you can find them drinking in the local pub. And that's the news. A lot can happen in just 1 week. We continue now with an update on those two humpback whales that staged a public relations stunt by heading up the Sacramento River just as the International Whaling Commission was preparing to hold their 59th annual meeting in Anchorage, Alaska. Well, last week we talked with Bernadette Fees, who was along the Sacramento River tracking the progress of Delta and Dawn, the two wandering whales that found their way up the Sacramento River There's been a lot of progress. When we last talked, they were stuck at the Rio Vista Bridge, and no one was quite sure what was going to happen. Bernadette, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sydney.
Well, this is Wednesday, and I'm going to let you make the announcement of where things are right now.
As of right now, there has been no confirmed sighting of either mother or calf. And so what our operations consist of are two vessels out working offshore, one of them being the Department of Fish and Game Patrol vessel, the Marlin, and the San Francisco Police Department vessel. We're also working within the vessel traffic system that the Coast Guard monitors for any of the commercial traffic that's moving through the bays and the straits. If they have a sighting, they can call that in. And there's certainly been a lot of media coverage, so the media helicopters that are up and around seeing if they can spot them are working with us and will let us know if there's a sighting. But at this point, Sydney, really what we're looking at is if we have not sighted these two by later this afternoon, it's rather reasonable to assume that they've made their way back out to the Pacific in their home.
Right. Well, actually, the interesting part of this is the fact that from the last time we talked to now, they have made it back into San Francisco Bay.
Last evening, when our operations suspended because of being nightfall, were just close to Tiburon, which put them within about a 5-mile range of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Well, listen, let's talk about the turnaround. Give us a little history. You've been following this every step of the way. Give us a little kind of color on what you were able to witness, because they were stuck, and then, of course, they moved past the bridge, but then kind of take it from there, because they had some dangerous water to get through, and they've succeeded.
Well, you've certainly noted one very important piece of this, and that is they have overcome several obstacles and, you know, a lot of odds, I think, in making their way, at least as far as we knew them to be last evening, and certainly if they're out into the ocean, even more of an accomplishment. There were several things that occurred during the course of their visit in the Sacramento River, and a lot of it involved certainly just the expert scientific staff that were working on this operation. There were several instances where new techniques and tactics were used to try to help navigate and direct the whales that we found to be effective. We also had several instances when we were able to collect health data that we otherwise did not have. There was also a real opportunity to collect other types of data that are going to be able to be used not only for humpbacks but also for other marine species. And that's purely because of the opportunity for the scientists to be able to spend, you know, a consistent amount of time monitoring and recording their activities and their behaviors and their health conditions. So that has been a real milestone that was capped off by the first time ever application of antibiotics to a whale in the wild.
I had no idea that was the first time that's been tried.
Yes, it was. And so that, again, was another exciting piece of it. When they started moving on Sunday, they did quite a trek, which we had experienced with them the week before. And when they started up again yesterday, that was another exciting piece, because when they started moving, they kept going. And in fact, we're stationed right now. Our command center is right on the Carquinez Strait, and we had the opportunity to walk and actually see them go by, which was just fantastic. So that was another certain memory and marker that I'll be able to take with me. And again, if they're out and they're back home, they've made it safely out into the Pacific, there isn't any better resolution or ending that we could hope for.
Now, one of the techniques that may have made a difference, I'd be curious about your opinion on this, and that was the use of water hose to try to get behind them and nudge them along. Do you think that made a difference?
Well, we certainly know that when we used the water hose last Friday, that we did get a response from the whales. It was successful in being able to turn them and actually have them adjust their course.
Did you ever get a sense that they, at one point, sort of figured this thing out?
You know, that's really hard to say. I don't know, certainly, what caused them to come upriver. nor do I know what prompted them to make their way back home. I know that these mammals are, they're magnificent, and they have a lot of abilities. I don't know how they really, you know, I don't even know if the scientists know how these whales would have been relating to us as we worked with them over these last almost 3 weeks. Whatever it was, whether it was instinctual, whether it was something that they were able to pull together, whether it was just a coming together of, you know, just several conditions that just gelled and made the time right, they just went on their way.
I have to believe somehow that since they love the salt water, that once they got the taste of the salt water, they said, I think we're getting closer. But that's my speculation. Who knows?
I'd love to think that as well. One of the things that I believe has really attracted the interest of the public with this situation is the fact that we're dealing with a mother and a calf. And that's, you know, home and family is certainly are at the center of a lot of American lives. And the fact that they knew how to make their way home is just a fantastic consideration.
To be honest with you, I wasn't sure that this was going to have a happy ending when we last talked, because they were really in a form of collapse. They were the mother in particular was so severely injured with a 2-foot gash, 6 inches deep into her blubber skin. That was pretty serious, and they'd been really out of their natural environment for quite some time. This appears to be, at least at this point, a relatively happy ending.
You're exactly right. We have been very, very hopeful that it would be a happy ending for these two whales, and certainly we feel very good about the fact that if we contributed to that in any way, then we've done our work, most certainly. And I'm real hopeful that we're going to be able to say at one point, at least if for no other reason, just because of our not finding them, that they have brought together that happy ending for them.
Were you able to radio tag these in any way?
You know, we weren't able to do that. We were able, though, to get some fantastic photographs and footage of these whales to include the back of their flukes, which, as I understand it from our marine mammal specialists, are like their thumbprint. The patterns, the skin pattern on the back of their flukes are individual identifiers. Certainly, NOAA, the Marine Mammal Center, Cascadia, a number of the other organizations that were involved in this effort, that is their continuing effort. So we're real hopeful that as they continue to do the great work that they're doing, they will someday, hopefully soon, encounter these two and be able to recognize them.
I guess fluke recognition is a real art, and there are people who just plain, that's what they spend their time doing. Under normal circumstances, where would they go from here?
You know, I can't say specifically, Sydney. We did take a biopsy of the mother as well as a biopsy of the calf in order to get several pieces of information, one of them being a determination of their stock. There is, of course, the speculation that they are within the Mexican-California migratory pattern. So if that is the case, and they were heading north as part of their migration, they would probably start again, working their way up north and possibly taking a side trip over towards the Fairlawns for a feeding opportunity or two.
I'm a dreamer. I love animals and a romantic, so I begin to wonder the tales that they tell as they join some of their own. How are they able, if they are, to communicate their story? That's just fun to speculate about. But the other thing that I love to think about is, so next year, assuming that they are part of this California migratory tribe of whales, when they come to this point, I just wonder what's going to go on in their mind. And I know in my own soul that they're aware of a lot of stuff.
Oh, wouldn't that just be fantastic? I know that a lot of folks have been asking us throughout the morning, you know, are we going to miss them? Are we sad that we didn't get to see them go? And certainly, this has been an exciting operation, especially one that appears to have ended so happily. And it is a situation where you have not only fish and wildlife professionals who are expert at their work, we're working with people for whom their work is their passion. And it's exciting to think that we would continue to have that connection with these two. And I'm grateful for the fact that the organizations will continue to have that connection. continuing to do great work on behalf of not only the humpback whale, but all the other marine species, and certainly, of course, to try to help keep that balance that has to exist between our environment, our wildlife, our ecosystems, and certainly our needs as humans as we continue to move forward.
Bernadette Fies is with the California State Department of Fish and Game. How long have you been with the department?
6.5 years.
Is this the beginning of your career?
Actually, no. I have been in civil service now for about 17 years.
Well, have you ever had anything quite this exciting in historically?
Not myself. Not personally. But that's one of the things that became very, very clear to me when I came to work with the California Department of Fish and Game. And that is, it is an organization. It is a group of people that not only come together and work well, they come together and do great things. And it has been the most exciting opportunity that I've had career-wise. And it is my hope, of course, that I end my career with the Department of Fish and Game. I've made it my home, and that's true for so many of the other people that I work with. And as we just talked about, being able to make your way home and know your way home, you can't get better than that.
Well, that's kind of where you're probably going to head. How soon do you expect to really call this a wrap?
Well, right now we are breaking down our command operations here at the Maritime Academy. The university campus has been so gracious in allowing us to have space. The information center will move forward. We will stay in operation. We're moving to the Gulf of the Farallones National Marine Sanctuary Office, and we'll continue to provide information that we have to the media so that that can be shared with the public. And it's quite probable that by the end of the week, I'll be heading back to Sacramento.
Well, I guess that's good news and bad news at the same time. That's the way life is when you have the great adventures.
Yes. You know, wasn't it Peter Pan that said to live is the greatest adventure? What an exciting thing. It doesn't get much more lively than what we've seen these last few weeks. And we have a lively crew. We have just a magnificent arena to work within, the natural resources of the state of California. And it's been a happy day.
Leave it to my new friend, Bernadette Fies, to come up with a quote from Peter Pan. First time on this radio show. Bernadette, we're going to talk again. Next time I talk, I'd love to know more about what the California State Department of Fish and Game is doing in California, and how people might be able to participate as visitors to the state, but as well local residents, too. So we'll have that conversation in the future. Thanks so much for all your work, and we'll keep in touch.
Thank you, Sydney. I look forward to it.
Our saga continues now as we head on up to Alaska, where the struggle between nations that have taken a stand to oppose whaling and those who continue to fight to maintain whaling, or more politically correctly stated, to continue their whale research projects by chasing, killing, hauling, flensing, canning, and selling their research byproducts primarily in supermarkets in Japan, is being fought out now in long and grueling sessions as we speak. I wish I could be up in Alaska right now, because this is a big year in terms of whales and whaling. Now, joining us from the International Whaling Conference 59 from Anchorage, Alaska, where it's happening this year, is Steve McDonald, who's the Assistant News Director at KTUU Channel 2 News in Anchorage, a TV station there. Steve, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks, Sydney.
The conference started, was it yesterday?
Conference actually got underway on Monday.
Okay.
This is day three of the conference.
How many people are there?
Well, quite a few. We've got over 70 nations. I believe it's 75 members now of the International Whaling Commission are here. It's the largest turnout that the commission has had at one of its annual meetings. And there's a pretty good-sized contingent of delegates as well as media from around the world here in Anchorage.
Right, it is. I think the big story right now is Japan and what's going to happen with the Japanese. They're interested in continuing their research whaling down in the Antarctic areas. And as well, they're trying to get the IWC to authorize whaling for their indigenous peoples. What's happening with that particular story?
Those are certainly the two most contentious issues at the IWC conference. Probably the most emotional of the two involves Japan's request to hunt 50 humpback whales that migrate into the Antarctic Ocean each fall. And this has really struck a nerve with the New Zealanders and the Australians. These whales breed and mate in the waters breed and give birth in the waters off Australia and New Zealand, and they've laid claim to these animals. They have a number of whale watching tours that have grown up around these whales, and they enjoy the whales as a business means, making money by watching them. So they feel an attachment to these humpbacks, and Japan. Japan wants to go down and hunt 50 of these. So the New Zealanders and the Australians have mounted fierce opposition to this proposal. There may be a bit of movement on that front. We're told that all three countries are meeting today, met a little bit yesterday as well, to discuss this request. And the Australians and the New Zealanders have made it clear that they want this request pulled off the table. And it remains yet whether or not Japan's going to comply with that request. And as he said, Japan also wants to establish a subsistence hunt for four coastal villages in its country. They say that subsistence hunting is allowed in Russia as well as here in Alaska. A number of villages, nine Eskimo native villages on the north slope of Alaska, are allowed to take bowhead whales. They've been doing this for centuries up on the north slope, and it's part of their culture. Japan says it wants to do the same with these four coastal villages.
What is Japan's interest in the humpback whales? I mean, that is a very controversial issue. Any idea why it is, in the face of all of this opposition, they keep pushing?
I spoke to a fellow by the name of Barry Gardner, who is a delegate with the United Kingdom, and he and a number of other countries feel that Japan just wants to go back to the old commercial whaling days. They feel that Japan is just trying to use this loophole. They say it's a loophole that allows a country to conduct research or scientific whaling, which Japan does, and they're just trying to expand this as much as they possibly can in order just to erode that ban on commercial whaling that was instituted in 1986. So this is what the conservation countries say, and they're trying to stop it cold. They feel that the proposal by Japan to institute subsistence whaling in these four coastal villages is nothing more than commercial whaling in disguise. The villagers are going to be allowed to sell the meat that they catch. And Alaska natives, by the way, are forbidden to do that. They use the meat for consumption and to get through the year. So they say that there's no real similarities at all between what the Alaska natives do and what the Japanese villagers would be allowed to do. So the conservation countries basically look at each thing that the Japanese are trying to do as just another way of eroding that commercial whaling moratorium. And if you talk to the Japanese, there's a gentleman who was one of their chief delegates, a fellow by the name of Joji Morishita. He basically says that there shouldn't be commercial and subsistence whaling. It should be all based on sustainable or unsustainable whaling. If a group of whales can handle hunting, because there's a good number of them, then they should be allowed to hunt those whales. If there's a group of whales that are endangered or on the endangered species list, then those should be off limits.
Well, of course, that seems to be a fair compromise, at least at some levels. But it always seems to morph from there. That's the part of the problem.
Which is what the British are saying, that if this is allowed, then where do we go from here? It just continues to be exploited further and further. And there was a great analogy made by the Russian delegate today. He says that sometimes if you stick your finger out, you get your finger bitten off up to your neck. And that was his analogy to describe what the Japanese were doing. Despite that colorful analogy, the Russians support what the Japanese are trying to do.
Oh, they do.
Yes, they do.
Because they typically, it seems to me, historically have been on the other side.
They also have a subsistence whaling quota that was just approved yesterday along with the Alaska Native quota.
Okay.
So I think they're looking at it along with those terms.
Now, of course, the subsistence side, so they're willing to abide by the concept of subsistence that it's not to be sold. And that's where the I wasn't sure about that, and I appreciate this clarification because I thought, well, if it can be done with indigenous people in Alaska and other nations, why not Japan? But they, if their intentions are to sell it, well, that's just a slap in the face.
But just to point this out too, Sydney, to be fair to the Japanese,
okay,
they're looking at Alaska natives as commercial whalers as well, because what they say is that while Alaska natives cannot sell the meat, and they use the meat for themselves and their villages, they claim where they cross over into commercialism is that the Alaska natives use the baleen, and they use the vertebrae, the bones of whales. They do scrimshaw, they do carvings, they weave baskets out of baleen, and they sell these things for hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars. And one of the things that Morishita pointed out during a news conference on Monday, he says, all you got to do is go down into the hotel lobby and go into one of these gift shops, and you'll see examples of this artwork by Alaska Natives. And he's right on that aspect, that Alaska Natives do indeed use every single part of that whale, and some of them make money off the artwork, but under U.S. law, Alaska Natives are indeed allowed to sell arts and crafts made out of whales. But again, what the conservation countries are saying is that, you know, the basic premise of this is, you know, you subsist off the meat, and Alaska Natives don't sell the meat, and the Japanese would be allowed to.
That kind of muddies up the debate a bit, doesn't it? Makes it more complex.
It's not real clean and clear. I mean, there are some good arguments made on both sides.
You know, part of the challenge for the Japanese is too bad the whales aren't more in their own backyard. I think part of the issue here is the fact that they end up going into other people's backyards to catch the whales, and it's also a messy operation. Whaling is not a pretty sight.
No, I have a 14-year-old son, and he watched my story two nights ago, and we had some video of Japanese whalers firing exploding harpoons into minke whales, and you see the whales and the blood, and, you know, they do not die a quick death. And my son has a strong attachment to whales. We've taken him over to Maui on a number of occasions, and he's gotten a chance to watch humpback whales there. And, of course, there's whales all around Alaska. We go down into Resurrection Bay just off the coast of Seward, and lots of gray whales, lots of humpback whales. In fact, we just saw one last weekend in Resurrection Bay. So we have an attachment and a connection to whales as well. And when he saw my story, he was very upset with me that video was shown on TV. And I try to explain that, you know, people have to understand that this is the reality of it, and this is what goes on out there. But you're right, they do roam all over, and it is not a quick process at all.
You know, this is a great irony in the sense that the two wayward whales that were swimming up the Sacramento River, which were humpback whales,
right,
they finally made it back down to San Francisco, and the whole world is watching.
Correct.
You know, the story that they've captured the attention of and the hearts and souls of literally millions of people. So it, again, I guess it depends on the perspective. That a mother whale and her calf heading up the river and back down again can be a story that is capturing CNN headline news. And yet at the same time, there's this other side, which in a whaling situation, well, we take 50 humpbacks out, and there's no simple answers to these things. What are people looking for in the days ahead?
Well, one of the things that the chairman of the IWC is very concerned about is time. Tomorrow is supposed to be the last day of the commission meeting. The Japanese realized that after the debate of this morning, they realized that a vote on their proposal to create the subsistence whaling in these four coastal villages would be futile today. So they asked the chair if they could have another day. So now this vote is going to be carried over into the final day. The chairman said this afternoon that he's really concerned about time, and therefore he is going to ask delegates to come back tonight because they've got they still have some Tuesday issues that they hadn't addressed yet. Here it is Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Probably will wind up being carried over into Thursday. Mm-hmm. There's also another interesting issue. Japan, again, has been the target of some environmental groups out on the high seas that have used some pretty aggressive tactics.
Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherd folks
you,
and others.
You said that. You're right. You got him. And he's up here in Anchorage. In fact, we're going to do a live interview with him tonight on our 5 o'clock news. And he was escorted by the police department outside the Captain Cook Hotel where the IWC commission meeting is being held. He's thought of as an agitator here among delegates. They don't want him even in the same building that they're in. So as soon as he walked in, the police, the security here is very heavy. They escorted him right back outside again.
Well, they've clashed directly in the open seas in the Antarctic.
And
last year was really very dramatic. It's been crescendoing, and it's getting very emotional.
And they're asking, the Japanese are asking the commission members to put more restrictions. I'm not really sure what they can do about this, but they're asking the IWC perhaps to put more pressure on port cities not to flag these vessels that belong to the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, which, of course, is Paul Watson's organization. So they're asking for more constraints against Watson and other environmental groups they feel become too aggressive out there on the seas.
You're not going to stop Paul Watson through a simple restriction. His claim, of course, is the fact that the Japanese are in protected waters where these animals are supposed to be protected. If they want to whale outside those waters, there's perhaps a better reason to do so, but this is a sanctuary.
That's a sanctuary, right? Yes.
And quite honestly, it's like, what are we supposed to do? I for myself, who love animals, I've talked to Paul, and I wish I could be on his ship. If for no other reason, it would be a great adventure, and I'm a reporter, so it'd be very interesting.
Well, you can be guaranteed you get an up-close view of a Japanese whaling ship.
Well, you...
Because he'll ram his boat into it.
Bump loggerheads. Very interesting. I guess there's a chance that their request to get this acceptance of indigenous whaling is maybe tabled, in which case it looks like it's going to be business as usual.
Well, as you know, Sidney, it takes, what, three-quarters majority to pass something.
Oh, wow.
And I don't think anybody has the votes one way or the other. Whether you have the simple majority or not, it's not going to help. You have to have that supermajority, I guess.
And just since I'm not there, it sounds as if Japan and a few other nations, I think it's like Norway and Denmark, or they have a few allies because have an interest in whaling. Give me a sense of how that dynamic it works out, because it's a very emotional issue.
It is. This is my first IWC meeting, and it's been very fascinating and just kind of watching some of the dynamics. On one side, you have the U.S. They call themselves the like-minded nations.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the U.S., you have Germany, Brazil, Australia, New Zealand, and, of course, the U.K. They all seem to be on one side. I think France is probably in there, Russia sometimes as well. But then on the other side, you've got Iceland, Norway, I believe Denmark.
I think so, yeah.
And they side with Japan. And you have a number of Caribbean nations that have sided. St. Kitts gave a very impassioned plea to support the Japanese proposal this afternoon regarding the four coastal communities and subsistence whaling. So the Caribbean has come to the side of Japan on this issue. So
why is that? I'm sorry, I missed that point. Is this politics? I know that Japan has been very generous with certain types of economic aid,
correct,
even to some landlocked countries who are now attending the IWC.
Correct, and we've asked Morishita about that during his news conference on Monday, and he says, you know, we give aid to 160 different nations around the world, just about as many nations as the U.S. gives aid to. He says, and there are some nations that we give aid to that don't support us at IWC.
Mm-hmm.
So he just kind of sloughed that off. No, we're not buying votes at all, but the point out there that critics will make that they're trying to just buy support.
Exactly. Well, I know that you're on deadline,
yes.
We're going to sign off here, but I want to thank Steve McDonald, who is the assistant news director at KTUU Channel 2 in Anchorage, Alaska, who's attending the IWC. Steve, thanks a lot for your update.
My pleasure, Sidney, anytime, and it was good spending time with you.
Thanks so much.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Somewhere in these struggles between whaling advocates, between writers and senators, is a slice of reality on planet Earth today. I close this tribute to Rachel Carson and her arch-rival, Senator Tom Coburn, with a final reading from an essay that Rachel Carson wrote in 1958 entitled Essay on the Biological Sciences. Only with the 20th century has biological thought been focused on ecology, or the relation of the living creature to its environment. Awareness of ecological relationships is, or should be, the basis of modern conservation programs, for it is useless to attempt to preserve a living species unless the kind of land or water it requires is also preserved. So deliberately interwoven are the relationships that when we disturb one thread of the community fabric, we alter it all, perhaps almost imperceptibly, perhaps so drastically that destruction follows. If we have been slow to develop the general concepts of ecology and conservation, we have been even more tardy in recognizing the facts of the ecology and conservation of man himself. We may hope that this will be the next major phase in the development of biology. Here and there, awareness is growing that man, far from being the overlord of all creation, is himself part of nature, subject to the same cosmic forces that control all other life. Man's future, welfare, and probably even his survival, depend on his learning to live in harmony, rather than in combat, with these forces. The Perceptions 50 Years Ago, by one of the defining voices of the Earth. One has to wonder how it is that a man born a year and a day before me, Senator Tom Coburn, could have missed so fundamentally the great mind and reason of so perceptive a scientist, visionary, and dedicated servant of humanity, people, place, and wonder. But that is as it is. To quote another great sage, two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Thank you, Robert Frost, and all of these wonderful guests, and especially you, my listeners, because together we will make all the difference. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth embraces the earth here on the Wild Side News.